Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. As we begin, I want you to try to envision the image that I want to present before you. I want you to think of a country road at night, empty road, big old tree with no leaves, and a couple of homeless men standing around the tree. Accept that image. The two men, their name is Vladimir and Estrogen, and they wait. They wait in the dark for a mysterious figure who promises to come, whose promise offers them the hope of redemption. What is his name? In the book, he says, Estrogen says, his name is Godot. Vladimir says, I think so. Now, with this rather pathetic scene, playwright Samuel Beckett began one of the 20th century's most famous dramas. It's called Waiting for Godot. And it asks some very important questions, questions about the meaning of life, and, well, questions that I want to just take a look at today and explore a little for what it's worth. Now, in the play, this play is basically these two homeless guys standing there on the side of the road waiting for this mysterious figure called Godot who promises to come. They keep saying he promises to come. They're told he's going to come. He's told he's going to come and he's going to solve all their problems and bring them salvation and redemption. And as they stand there on the side of the road, a whole progression of human suffering and people comes by them. And basically, they're bored, not so much by the pain that they see, but by the usefulness, the uselessness of it all. You know, at one point in the play, they want to try to do some good, and they see a blind man who stumbles. So Vladimir says at one point, he says, a diversion comes along. What should we do? Come, let's get to work. In an instant, all will vanish, and we'll be alone once more in the midst of nothingness. So they want to go try to help some blind man stumble, but when they go to help him, they fall and they can't get up. And besides, what does it matter? Because in an instant, we'll all be gone and it'll all mean nothing. Now, despite more promises that Godot will come and he's going to offer them salvation, they get kind of depressed and discouraged and they decide they're going to hang themselves. Well, so they get a rope and they're going to hang themselves and they try to, he takes his belt. One of them takes their belt off and he's going to hang himself with the belt. Well, the pants fall down and, you know, they try to hang themselves with the rope and they can't do it. And they decide, well, we can't hang ourselves today. Maybe we'll try it again tomorrow. At one point, Vladimir says, we'll hang ourselves tomorrow. And then he says, unless Godot comes. And if he comes, the one says, well, we'll be saved. So that's this idea. It's just the uselessness and meaninglessness of life. But they got this hope of this mysterious figure who's supposed to come. Well, in the story, Godot never comes, which means, of course, in the end, they're never saved. And yet, that's the whole point. They were never meant to be saved. And that's why, from the first time this play was performed in Paris, Samuel Beckett's drama, Waiting for Godot, it basically ends with these two atrophied souls living in an existence that they can't escape. They hate the existence, but they can't get out of it. Nor should they even try because they had, but they weren't sure they should try because they kept on living with this promise. This promise that this Godot is going to come and he's going to save them. That Godot never comes almost doesn't matter. What matters is the promise, the hope that they have that he will. Now, these words are from Beckett's most popular play, really have become probably the most merciless and cruel anti-Christian polemic since Voltaire, writing, you know, in the 18th century. See, it's hard for me to imagine any serious Christian who believes in the second coming of Jesus not seeing himself or herself somehow caricatured to some degree in these two pathetic guys and their attempts to balance their doubts about the absurd suffering in human life with this hope of Godot coming and with a loving God who has promised to bring it all to an end and bring all pain and suffering to an end, and yet it never happens. Now, you know, you think about this too. There's a point here. You know, I think it was the Apostle Peter who in one of the Bible books said something about in the last days, mockers are going to come saying we are waiting for his promise and things continue on as they've been. Well, you know, I mean, Peter, you know, according to your contemporary John, Jesus promised to come quickly, and that was like, what, 1900 years ago? And after all those centuries, things are kind of going on as they were. Thus, to be fair, it seems like the scoffers would have a point. I mean, Peter and John probably never imagined getting as far as 1953. Beckett didn't have to imagine it. Beckett was there. Okay, so you see, this is what he's doing. He's sort of mocking this whole Christian worldview of the promise of the second coming, and where is it? So at the same time, though, Beckett just didn't mock the Christian worldview with this play. He mocked the secular worldview as well. He mocked, you know, the whole idea of trying to live without hope, the whole idea of trying to live without the promise of something beyond the earth and the conditionality of its gifts. Because, you know, think about it, folks. We came out of the earth, and friends, sooner or later, you're going to go right back into the earth as well. So what's worth, and this is the question I think Beckett asks with his play, Waiting for Godot, to live with a false hope, in his mind, Christianity was a false hope, or to live with no hope at all? These are the questions that Beckett asks. As I said, however unkind to Christianity, Waiting for Godot was even worse to the secularist. Beckett asked the question that I think, well, pretty much has deflowered every quiet moment of the post-Christian world. And that question is, how does one live a life that has no meaning? How do you live a life that ultimately has no meaning? Well, I think you live it pretty asininely, as the pathetic characters in this play revealed. Think about it. Think about your life. If you have no clue as to the purpose of your existence, when you have only deluded hypotheses and, you know, things about how you even got here, about your origins, when all you could do is speculate, and even grossly at that, on what death brings, and that's really logically the most important question. You know, if you think about it, what are you going to live? 50, 60, 80 years, and boom, and then you're dead for a long time? If you speculate at that, then, you know, you don't even know anything about that, then it's a wonder that humans live even as well as we do. See, Waiting for Godot, I believe, divided reality into two spheres. And I've talked about this before, and I want to come back to this again. One sphere is the typical mechanistic, atheistic, secular, scientific view of the world, where every truth is basically reduced down to mathematical equations. Okay, it's all math, it's all physical, it's all science, it's all formulas, that's all we are. It's chemicals, atoms in the void, as the ancient Greeks called it. The other view, which is mocked in this book as well, is the idea that there is transcendence, that there is an existence greater than what we see and feel and taste and touch, and that there really is a creator who offers us something more than just what this world has to offer. In the first one, well, man is the means, he's the ends, he's the one in whom it all culminates and climaxes. I mean, that's it. We're the beginning, we're the middle, we're the end. When we're gone, it's all gone, and that's it. When you die, it's over and done. Your story's over. Finished. No more. That's the first view. In the second, God is the ultimate climax. In the first, humanity is the subject of truth. In the second, it's the object. And a vast gulf exists between the two. See, I think ultimately what this play presents, even though it presents it in a very negative light, and I don't agree with a lot of it, basically we're presented with two options. If the atheists, if the secularists, if the science as it's now practiced are correct, then what we believe, what we do, really in the long run, doesn't really matter. The end's the same for anyone, regardless of what you believe. I mean, we all wind up in the ground, we all wind up dead, gone forever, regardless of what you believe. That's it. If the second one is true, then, and there is a God, there is a transcendence, there is an eternity to win or to lose, then, well, everything suddenly becomes a little more intense, a little more important. One or the other. There's really no middle ground here. In the end, there is either a God who offers us something beyond this world, or there's not. That's it. Period. Finito. You're dead. It's over and done. You know, about a week or two ago, there was a car wreck in front of my house at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I got out there. I was one of the first ones out there before the cop got there. And some kid speeding plowed into a couple trees. The car flipped on him. He wasn't wearing a seatbelt. And he went through the windshield partially, and then the car flipped on him. So I come up at night, you know, with a flashlight. I'm looking, and I see this car on its side. And then I just see this thing protruding, and I think that's not what I think it is. And I look, and all that was the guy's bloody head, and the car was laying on his neck. And the cop and I go over, and we're pushing the car. We're pushing the car, trying to get the car off the guy's neck. And yet in the midst of, you know, and ultimately the guy, to make a long story short, he died. But the point is, I'm looking at that guy, that bloody wreck, and I realize, my goodness, if this is it, folks, if this world is all there is, that's it, then there's nothing else. And I remember thinking, man, if there is no God, if there is no eternity, if that's it, then we're all just a car wreck away from being to oblivion. And it jumped out at me more. And that's what I think Beckett did here with his five unenviable characters on a barren stage. I think Beckett basically dramatized the West's most immediate dilemma. Quote, God is dead, and so where do those leave us made in his image? For Beckett, they're left between hard fetters, you know, between Christ haven't come, and, you know, he hasn't come yet, and then the hopelessness if because he hasn't. Between these two cold fates, humanity's manacled in a bond that offers no escape. How could it when the knot itself is made of all reality, when it's woven of the only options possible, and that's just life here? If there isn't that hope, we have nothing. Nothing to be done is what this character says time and again in the play. One of the characters says nothing to be done because there's nothing to do, because frankly nothing can be done. Not in a godless universe where our most inflexible and compromising enemy accepts no surrender and takes no prisoners. Okay? Death is a foe that is impossible for us to escape because it's part of what we're made of. In a naturalistic, single-tiered universe, what is life? What is death? But different mixes of the same brew. You know, in the end, and the atheistic worldview is true, the living are just kind of a pubescent version of the dead. Now, again, this isn't new. From the pre-Socratic philosopher Protagoras, who once says, as for the gods, I have no mean of knowing that they exist, up through modern a priori materialism, you know, there's been just this whole naturalistic view of the world has left us with nothing. You know, in the thousands of years of human history, it's only been in the past few hundred years that this naturalistic view of the world has kind of taken over. You know, see, for hundreds of years, men slit each other's throats because they couldn't agree on what God did to them after their throats were slit. Today, there's this basic belief that there's no God to do anything to us after our throats have been slit. Never before had there been such a widespread, you know, belief in this that has pushed the Creator out of existence. Men always believed that there was a Creator one way or another. And now we live in a day and age where that has been pushed out completely, and it's certainly seen in our educational system. So what we are the heirs of this idea because we're so used to it, you know, that we've forgotten how radical it is. Why bother with the texts of the dead when there's the scientism of the living? You know, what can Jeremiah, Isaiah, and Paul teach us in the era of Newton or Einstein? You know, and you know, what do we need these things for? Who needs the Lord moving over the face of the deep when we got Darwin's beagle? I mean, the secular worldview has just taken over so much in the West. You know, years ago there was a special relativity, Albert Einstein's special relativity, and it was ultimately some guy stuck his telescope up in the sky and he proved special relativity. Well, you can prove that a lot easier. You can prove the second coming of Jesus. You know, I can't prove that the same way. I need faith to believe that Jesus is going to come back. I don't need faith to believe for every action there's an opposite and equal reaction. So in other words, the scientific worldview has taken over so much, and yet, in the end, it's so insufficient. Do you really want to believe this? Do you really believe we're all just atoms in the void? Do you ever read Tennyson's poem, Enoch Arden, about this guy who was shipwrecked and comes back? Do you ever read the poetry of Joseph Brodsky? These things access a dimension. There's something there. I just think science and materialism are too crude, too bulky, too broad to enter. There's a dimension where reason is just too hard, too inflexible to pass through. You can explain the passion of Shakespeare's King Lear with some kind of algorithm. What mathematical formula explains the singing of birds outside your window? Well, how are you going to break down Van Gogh's the painting where the crows and the wheat failed right before he died? You're going to use formulas to do these things? However strong the scientific worldview has been, something's missing. Something's missing of that. Centuries ago, I think it was, Newton who said, "Oh God, I think thy thoughts after thee." Well, a few centuries later, I believe Stephen Hawking, who sits in the same chair, basically once said, human beings are just a chemical scum on the face of the earth. Something has greatly been diminished by this belief, just pushing transcendence out, and we're just atoms, we're just the void, we're just all chemicals. Do you really think that's all that you are? Do you think your loves, your passion, your emotion, all that stuff can be just explained chemically? I read a scientist, a philosopher, historian of science, Michael Pagliani. I think he's dead now. And he's a chemist, PhD, and so on. And he was very interesting. In the book, he said the basic things of science, the basic mode of science is totally nonsensical because it attempts to reduce all reality. It attempts to reduce all reality to just, mechanical things, numbers, formulas, and so on. He said it's ridiculous because you can't do that to life. You can't do that to things. And so he was very strong on that. And yet, again, this is what we're raised on. And yet not only and it's not just the divine has been taken out, but the whole idea of reality has suddenly become so narrow. Whole aspects of human existence, this transcendence and all that which dominated life is gone. It's now crammed into this narrow scientific thing. That's just science. It's logic. It's reason. It could all be explained through formula. Ethics, love and hate and hope. These things are more than just chemicals. You could take the periodic table of elements and you can mix all those chemicals together any way you want. I don't care how you want to do it, any way you want. And no matter how finely you tune them or whatever, that's not going to explain heroism. It's not going to explain passion. And, to think that they can is almost like equating a Pavarotti singing The Barber of Seville, equating that with belching or something. A world that limits its world and its view only to rationalism, only to materialism, only to scientific atheism misses so much of what's beyond it, which is so much of us, of who we are, of what we hope for, of what we aspire to, of what we imagine. You're going to limit that all to chemicals, to atoms in the void. The things that we dream about and laugh and cry about. And, are these just chemicals? Does chemical scum envision other worlds? Does it envision eternity? Does it write the Hamlet? Does it weep for the pain of others? Does it desire immortality? Does it seek the good? Does it seek to love? But again, what I'm saying is this is what the scientific worldview is telling us. This is what it's reducing us all to, and I just don't buy it. That chemicals and all that are part of it, of course, no one's going to deny that. No one's going to deny that, you pop some pills and your whole mood changes. Who's going to deny that? That they're part of it, of course, but they're all of it. Never, never accept that. And I can't understand how anybody really would. I think you ultimately have to lie to yourself. And think about this, too. Think about if the typical scientific worldview is correct. If that's all correct, all atoms in the void, then really, How do you ultimately say human beings are morally responsible for anything? Just think about that. If physical laws alone control us, then we're like the wind or we're like combustion. You know, any society based on pure materialism, if we really believe the purely materialistic view of science, you know, then how can people arrest child molesters or murderers or thieves and so on? Because they're machines. They can't help what they're doing. You know, we're no different. Who can ascribe moral culpability to a gizmo? It would be like putting an Uzi on trial for murder. No society, even the ones we live in, glossed over with all the scientivism and all that, you know, allows people to escape moral culpability, except the insane. Thus, if scientific materialism is true, we'd all have to be lunatics. Every culture, every society, you know, makes people, you know, holds people to account for their moral actions, and it just doesn't make sense in a purely materialistic worldview. See, it's obvious. It's obvious. I know chemicals, I know all that, but we're motivated by something more than what we immediately perceive. We're motivated by more. There's something in us more than just can be broken down into chemicals, even if we don't know what or how it works, but only that it's there and it's real, and without it, we're not alive, we're not free, we're not human. I mean, how could we even have thoughts? How could we even think transcendent thoughts if there were not something about us greater than nature, something greater than the sum of the chemicals, something more to our minds than just the soggy blob of pulsating meat that's in our head? You know, can the cause be greater than the causes? Can chemicals alone, no matter how complicated, could chemicals alone think? Love and fear. Do you really believe that's all that is? All right, sure, I know they might be able to go into your brain and see that when you fear, you release serotonin or this or that. But chemicals alone, no matter how complicated, can they do that? Have you ever read Flaubert's Madame Bovary or St. Augustine's Confessions? Are these really nothing but the results of chemical reactions going on inside the brain of Gustave Flaubert and Augustine? Oh, I have no doubt why if they were writing it, if somebody stuck wires on their brain and could test these things, they'd find a little more of this chemical, a little more. I'm not going to doubt that. Nobody in their right mind doubts that today. But is that all that there is? You're going to limit that? Isn't there more to the imagination than just quanta of neurotransmitters lunging across synaptic clefts? I mean, in the end, what does our brain do? Otherwise, what do we secrete thoughts like our liver does bile? I mean, how do we understand that? See, in the end, friends, despite everything that science tells us, everything that we're taught, everything that's attempt to reduce us all to chemicals, to reduce us all to purely physical processes, which is, if there is no God, and it's just the Big Bang, you know, and all the rest, then what else are there? We're not glorified rocks. You know, we're not, maybe the Hope Diamond is, but not us. You can take, you know, mud and you can do all that you want to it, but in the end, you can kick it on and on and on you could do with it. But it's never going to, in and of itself, it's never going to create human thought, human passion, human imagination. And they're going to come up with all the great scientific discoveries. They can map more of the brain. They can go further into the atom. They can do all that. That's fine. I'm all for that. But it's never, never going to believe that we could all be reduced to that alone. You know, one of my favorite writers and philosophers, I've quoted him here before, is Bertrand Russell, hardcore atheist apologist and just a brilliant guy. I've never ceased to be amazed by how smart the guy is, even though I agree with him, don't agree with him. But Russell once in an interview once said, what science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know. Woo! That's brash. But that's Russell. What science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know. Now, really? That we can't really know love? Because how is science really going to explain love? It's just neurohormonal things going on. How can we know hate? How can we know mercy? How can we know good or evil or happiness or art or transcendence or faith or at least how can we know them anything other than versions, different versions of indigestion, high cholesterol, or bunions? But because we do know something, you know, that's transcending these things, something greater than these things, because we know more, I don't buy that. I don't buy that, no matter how much science tells us that. You know, there was in the end, ultimately, reason has reigned as the supreme king of the Western world. Yet, how do we justify reason? We can only justify reason with other reason. In other words, we justify it by other reason, and you go on and on and on and on. Ultimately, you can never get a complete justification. You got to stop somewhere. And that makes me think of something that a scientist, Timothy Ferris, coming of age in the Milky Way. And I liked what he said in one of his books, and I want to kind of close with this. Timothy Ferris, he said, for this is important because it's coming down to what I'm trying to say in the end. He says, in short, and this is coming of age in the Milky Way, oh, I told you that. In short, there is not and never will be a complete comprehensive scientific account of the universe that can be proved valid. What? Isn't that interesting? There'll never be a complete view, scientific view. What does it mean then? It means maybe you have to ultimately take it on faith. Could it be that the limits of science require faith? But isn't faith something that belongs to another age, a pre-scientific, an age of myth? Well, maybe, but in the end, if you can't take it on, if you can't give a total scientific answer, then you got to take it on faith. What a paradox. The very system that verbally refutes faith. Science, well, faith isn't for science. Yet in the end, it's calling us to reach out ultimately to faith, something that we can't know any other way.